All right, Erev Tov, we are now through our, a little bit through our discussion of preparing for Shabbos. And we spoke out the Takana of Ezra, doing washing laundry on Thursday, discussed how it applies today. And then we branched off into discussing the nature of a Takana Drabanan, which the reason doesn't apply anymore and would still have. But it still have teeth. And the example is, of course, this takana of washing on Erev Friday, on Thursday. So now we then test, we started on page 41. We'll just quickly go through it again. The concept of tasting the food that you cook for Shabbos. So the Mishnah Berurah writes in the name of the Arizal that a person should taste the Shabbat foods on Friday to assure that they have been prepared and flavored properly. So interesting is this concept. What is behind this particular recommendation by the Arizal? Now you could simply say that the mitzvah is to honor Shabbos with good food, and therefore you want to make sure the food taka is good and is balanced well, so you're going to taste it and work out whether you should add spices or not to get it to its level best that you can. So that would be one way of looking at the whole story. The other way of looking at it is to suggest that there's something more than that idea going on here. And I would say that this is probably, I would more or less almost suggest that this is what's behind the Arizal. The Arizal, I don't necessarily think that, I don't think the Arizal is actually driving at the concept of the food tasting as good as it can be in isolation. In other words, I think there's more in the honor of Shabbos, and there's more that's going on here when you say, taste the Shabbos food, Erev Shabbos. I think there's more than just the actual taste of the food. And I think it's borne out by I mean, it's a whole discussion, but I'll just give it to you in a nutshell. One of the major clashes within the early world of Hasidim and Isnagdim, was a concept which the Misnagdim found very, very offensive. And the Hasidim were very motivated by this idea. And the concept is really called, Avodah Begashmiut. And the idea behind it is very interesting. It says like this. It says that the idea behind it is that one asks the big question as to how to define the relationship between a human being and Hashem, or the universe. Is Hashem considered immanent or transcendent? Is he close to us or is he very distant from us? Now, if you emphasize the immanence of Hashem, that is, that everything is here, doable, Hashem's right near us, then by extension, a concept will be understood that one can serve Hashem not just by being spiritual, but by being physical too. That every enjoyment of the physical world can be elevated to a service of Hashem. If you hold that Hashem is transcendent, and that's the focus, you've got to elevate yourself to a level worthy of climbing the spiritual ladder to get closer to Hashem, then you can see that that way of life is going to be very, look very askance at the idea of taking physical things and turning them into a service of Hashem. It's rather going to be, dealing with the world of the physical in very restrained way, in a very restrained way. You don't want to let it take over. Problems start to exist at that point in time. So these two worldviews collided, in the advent of Hasidism, and the Misnagdim, Gaon of Vilna and others, their reaction to these kind of situations. Now, one of the major areas of difference between the two approaches is this concept of how far Avodah B'Gashmiut goes. So just to give you an idea, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. This Mishnah is quoted by Rabbi Elimelech of Lozhensk. He one of the famous, he was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mesrich, and he was the one of the major leaders in that generation after the Baal Shem Tov. So he has a Mishnah, it's like a well-known Mishnah in Masechet Avot, that quotes a teaching of Rabbi Akiva. And the Mishnah basically says that Rabbi Akiva says, Schok v'kalut rosh, any kind of, not messing around, but merriment and kalut rosh is frivolity, I guess. Essentially, margilin le'erva will get a person used to licentiousness. So you've got to be very restrained in how you allow yourself to be entertained. And then the Mishnah continues, Rabbi Akiva continues, that masoret siag la'Torah, tradition is going to protect, Torah from being broken or trampled on. And the next example is masrot, taking tithes, is a siag la'osher. It'll protect you, and the consequence will be a brocha from Shemaim to become wealthy. So if you give tzedakah, the reward will be reaping wealth. Nedarim, making a neder, so that's siag la prishut. It's a fence that encourages or protects the concept of abstinence. Prishut is to separate, from having something. So if you've got a difficulty in controlling what you eat or what you drink, so then you make a neder saying, I forbid upon myself, Coca-Cola, cigarettes, whatever it may be. And that way I turn it into a religious precept, not just it's always a religious precept to look after yourself, but even more, it becomes a neder. So that strengthens, the ability and gives you the motivation to resist temptation in these kind of areas. So this is the whole Mishnah. And the last statement of the Mishnah is that shtika, keeping quiet, siag b'chokhmah. It's a fence, to allow a person to become wise. Because if you listen more than you talk, you'll pick up something. So these are all the examples that are spoken out in the third perek of Pirkei Avot. Now, Rabbi Elimelech asks the question, out of all of these growth steps, spiritual growth steps in the Mishnah, what strikes him as needing explanation is that Maaser is a siag la'osher. All of the others seem to be engaging you in spiritual growth. They've got nothing to do with anything physical. They, of course, work with physical parameters. But over here, the idea seems to, why do you want to create a fence for wealth? If the goal is the goal, what's the goal there exactly? So if you want to say that the action at hand, which is recommended, is going to lead to a greater level of spirituality. So, Chok v'kalut rosh, will margil erva. If you get into too much entertainment, you'll just, you won't be able to protect yourself from slipping into benefiting from erva. And then it starts with masoret. Tradition is a siag la'Torah. The goal is to keep Torah. Masoret is tradition. Protects Torah from being broken. So then the next thing is Masrot Siag L'Osher. How does that fit into the set of what's going on here? It sounds like it's different than Nedarim, Siag L'Prishut, and Shtika, is a Siag L'Chochma. Sounds like a little, it's like an exception. Doesn't seem to fit the set so well. That was his question. So he reinterpreted this particular concept. And he said like this. He says that we need to reinterpret that Masrot Siag LeOsher as a pathway to spiritual growth as well. And the way that he interpreted it was is to say that if you say something is the fence to something else, so what's the ikar and what's the tafel? What's the goal and what's the, the secondary activity? So yeah, he wants to say that in all the other activities, the Yetzirah will give you a hard time, but the challenge will not be nearly as hard as with things like tzedakah, because there's nothing harder than serving Hashem with your physical drives. A person's learning or doing a mitzvah, it's automatically inherently holy. The Yetzirah tries to chop you, but it's within a holy context. The Yetzirah is trying to climb in there, but the activity is holy to begin with. There's a certain level of protection there, as inherent in the actual act. But when it's something physical, whether it's wealth or it's any biological drive that you're satisfying, it's much harder to do that lishma in the service of Hashem, because the environment is totally physical. So he wants to suggest that that's exactly what's happening over here. That the goal, you need something to protect the goal, which is wealth. That's the ikar is wealth, not money. Wealth, spiritual wealth within the world of the physical. So you need to do something like a mitzvah of Maaser in order to allow yourself to see Hashem in the actual physical of the physical drives of eating, of accumulating wealth, etc. Because the goal is to elevate everything physical to a level to service of the divine. That's how I interpret the Mishnah. Now, this is exactly by extension what happens with food. When you look at the minhagim that Hasidim developed, there are minhagim that if you're not born into it or you haven't read about it, you don't expect to find a level of meticulous observance to details within the consumption of food. Because it's sort of like if you've got a nice piece of food for Shabbos or for Yontif, okay, dayenu. The periphery to make sure that there's everything else around you to enjoy this and enjoy that and have this and taste that and a whole smorgasbord, that you might even feel is going over the top. You don't need it. You've already done the mitzvah by having beautiful challah, fresh challah, good meat, or whatever your main course is. Then all the other extra stuff, how important is it really? Is it not just ensnaring you? So let's say, for example, like this. We have people who belong to kiddush clubs. And a kiddush club only takes place on Shabbos, I guess at first, right? That's only what it is on Shabbos. Everybody's the whole vibe is amazing. It's kiddush, So, what do you say about that? That's like, wow, we're taking the ability to socialize over a l'chaim, on Shabbos. If you want to elevate the l'chaim to a service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's the best way to do it. But you got to then watch what happens, right? The Yetzirah climbs in there, and all of a sudden, it's not just like a l'chaim; it becomes a whole story, and then it like spills over into all areas. And if you can't restrain yourself, then you're sloshed by the end of Kiddush. You're like half a wreck at the beginning of lunch, where you're going to enhance your service of Hashem with more alcohol. And then by the end of lunch, you're like comatose. And the wife's got to pick up the pieces with the kids, and you knock out until Mincha. And then you've got the whole problem of how much to have. And the whole issue then becomes a social problem. But it all started Lishma, in the service of Hashem. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the kind, and that's the kind of struggle that one has with these things. How much does one getting this minhag of having l'chaims at shul? Who started that, and where did it come from, and how did it become so prominent? You see what I'm saying? It starts with an ideological approach that it's a good idea. Obviously, they don't mean for the consequences to go beyond one's control. But it starts off by taking something physical and saying, there's a way to use this in service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's a real hard mitzvah to do, because normally a person, does it for that. The goyim will go to the pub after work every single day and get completely paralytic and go home and become who knows what, right? We take that drinking, and we do it in a mitzvah, by honoring Shabbos or Yontif. That's the idea behind it. Now there are many, many different minhagim that different groups of Hasidim came up with. So today we don't even bat an eyelid so much at it, but the minhagim to have different foods, like a smorgasbord of foods, some Friday night, some Shabbos morning, some Shana Shudas, what you have to have, all representing, different aspects of Avodat Hashem. And often they will, parallel, that they'll parallel what they think that what Alpi Kabbalah is understood to be a parallel in the Beit HaMikdash. You'll look at different ways that you go to Hasidim for a meal. You'll see that certain Hasidim will have a farfel for a dish, a certain type of fish, a certain type of meat, and with the gravy, without the gravy. And it's not just kilo because they like it. It's like there's somebody's come up with an intriguing explanation of why it's parallel to a certain level of spiritual growth. The concept of seeing spiritual growth within the physical nature of foods is a real unique, it's a very unique approach, which the Hasidic movement made very, very famous. Now it's easy to see how people were engaged with such a thing. If you're going to eat, then you want to eat well, so have the, oh, this is kind of like, the farfel is it's zecher lemikdash in the nature of the fact that it's lechem apanim, and the lechem apanim was warm. The farfel must be warm. If the farfel came cold to the table, you missed the whole story. So I'm not judging it. I'm just simply saying there are two worldviews. And the Graz opposition to this was that where's this mitzvah coming from? Where you turned it into a new mitzvah, a new Torah came up here, and it just will lead you into trouble. The Eitz Oritz is waiting to help you in these areas.
But it's in general physicality.
In general, but I think it's specifically focused on this in these areas, right? So, I mean, so the Graz will come along and say, you've done your mitzvah to enhance Shabbos. With what we call the basics today. You have wonderful meat, you have your, he even went to fastest, have kind of like a very basic dish to eat during the week, and a slightly upper level of basic on Shabbos. I mean, the Hasidic way is much nicer. It's much more attractive. People of a simcha. All the time. That's exactly, the Gaon's approach is to be poresh, is to distance oneself from the pleasures of the world. In other words, that's if you really want to become a tzaddik, you want to Don't indulge. Don't indulge. Don't let yourself go. Indulgence is kind of like a petach, an opening for the Yetzer Hara to go wild.
Really join the
Right.
indulgence to some.
Yeah. So, the enjoyment, you have to have that balance.
It's just where did the whiskey come?
Because the concept of the warmth of having alcohol when it's cold in winter Russia, and the idea of yain and alcohol finding a place within the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the two together was given license and legitimacy, such that the genius of the Hasidic approach was to take something that, let's call it, the average person on the street, was always battling or always wanted it, but couldn't find a license in it because it was always like, this is dangerous, this is not good for you. And yeah, it gave it a twist where it's good for you. It's good for you, and it has spiritual properties.
There's a story about Rabbi Nachman with Rabbi Nosson and Rabbi Tani, one of his other Talmidim. They were finding there was a bottle of whiskey there, and he saw like Rabbi Tani eyeing it. So he took a tiny little cup and he poured a little bit and gave it to each of them. So Rabbi Tani says to Rabbi Nosson, he says, "Little bit is also good." Rabbi Nachman said, "When it comes to alcohol, only a little bit is good."
Yeah. So anyway, this is really this was the huge machlokes between, let's call it, the Mishnagdim and the Chasidim, and the chiddush of the Hasidic approach was that at first glance you'd think that this kind of focus on details of food as having spiritual properties was for, the tzaddikim, the rebbes. But the chiddush was no, it expanded to include everybody. And the danger of overindulgence was given less shown less concern than the inability to be besimcha for all other good results that will come from it. And this
So isn't
became
it fair to
the
say, isn't it also, one should also look at the context, because like overindulgence wasn't exactly a big danger generally in the time when that was all coming down. People lived such hard, impoverished lives.
Yeah, it was probably easier, but still, they were arguing on this fundamental level philosophically. Then the question, of course, is, how to rescue, I mean, how to elevate the Jewish world to a state of simcha. And, this was kind of the divergence of the two different paths. Today, in a sense, we sort of like the beneficiary of kind of like a hybrid, where we start to see, yeah, it's fantastic, but it also needs control, and we have that, but then it became a huge issue. You know what I mean? It became a massive point of contention. Anyway, I'm simply bringing this in because I really think that that's what's happening over here. I think that we're gonna see it often. We're gonna see it as we every any mitzvah that's gonna come across us, with regard to Kavod Shabbos and food, there's going to be two levels of it. Level number one is simply to honor Shabbos. Level number two is that there's going to be a parallel to a spiritual component, whether in the Beit HaMikdash or specifically towards spiritual growth, which is going to be invested in the food that we take. Why is the Mishnah Berurah only quoting the Arizal? Meaning, why is the Arizal at the behind this concept of tasting the food Erev Shabbos? It's because there's a Kabbalistic principle at work over here, which means that there's kind of a sanctity of Shabbos that's already, it's already invested in the food. It's got certain spiritual properties. And that's why I think there's something here more than just the actual tasting of the food. I mean, if you look in the footnote here, So yeah, he quotes the Mishnah Bura quotes V'ayin B'Sefer Shulchan Shlomo that there's kind of a hint to this idea of tasting the Shabbos food before Shabbos, where quotes from the Musaf on Shabbos, Tu'amei Achayim Zachu, those that taste it will merit Olam Haba. So you know, you sort of a play on the words, right? Of course, the pshat is those who taste Shmirat Shabbat, you know, keeping Shabbos. But it's a play here. So you see the... No, it's a nice little limud. But it's then... but you see here in footnote 34, the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham is one of those Achronim who also very influenced by Kabbalah, adopted Kabbalistic approaches. So when you... Even though, you know... He wasn't a chassid, but he had a very Kabbalistic bend in the way he looked at things. So kind of like a Kabbalistic misnagid, you know what I mean? You see how they were students of Kabbalah more than Kabbalists, if you know what I mean. You know? So yeah, the Magen Avraham quotes it from the Arizal as well as the Beit Yosef, citing the Shibboleth HaLeket, though they do not specify the reason for it. So yeah, the footnote says one can explain in one of two ways, either to ensure that the food tastes good or as a mitzvah of demonstrating honor to Shabbos, even if one does not need to verify the taste. You know, what I'm suggesting is a different approach. I'm saying it's got more to do with the nature of this, you know, engaging with the spiritual components of Shabbos, Erev Shabbos already, in the nature of food and how it represents that. And that's why I think Alpi Kabbalah, there's something deeper going on here. And I think when we get to the Minhagim that we'll probably come across in the Sefer, I haven't seen it, I haven't got that far yet, but, you know, the Minhag to have fish and what type of fish and the Minhag to have, you know, chicken as opposed to meat or, you know, what kind of challah, how to braid the challah, how many strands, you know, how to hold the challah, how to, you know, hamotzi, the bottoms, you know, you put the bottoms together. Where's all this coming from? You know, what kind of, you know, eat the food. But no, there's more, there's an opportunity to elevate the physical to a service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's been invested in everything we do with something physical. Happens to be that in food and drink there's a lot that goes on, but it happens in everything, clothes as well, you know what I mean? It's like this is exactly what, if you're gonna have a special kind of kapota or gown or what dress or whatever it is for Shabbos, once you're gonna have something bukovedik, so have it this way, like let it represent something too, you understand what I'm saying? It's not. It's a real interesting approach, which has taken hold over the centuries from the time that it was instituted. But I think that is, it's possibly what I haven't yet seen it in the Mefarshim on the Shulchan Aruch. But it came to my mind while I was reading this, saying, you know, I wonder if this concept is, you know, already. You know, is it taking shape over here already? You know, because preparing for Shabbos is part of this. The things that you do in preparation for Shabbos, what's the tasting of the food? If you know that the food in general is the same recipe that you use every single time. Okay, so in the old days, it was kind of like, you know, the Baba or the mother just knew exactly how much salt to pinch. There wasn't kind of a measuring cup. It's more or less, you know, somehow there's an intuition about it. So maybe you say, okay, you want to taste it. But I think there's something more that's going on over here. I think it's part of this whole, you know, Weltanschauung of being able to elevate the, you know, our physical enjoyment to a service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what I think is going on over here. Now, even Misnagdim do that too. Right? We've all got to eat, you know. But I think that it took on a huge added dimension, you know, when you were looking at it kind of like as a real avoider, you know. You would, you know what I'm saying? It's like if you were sitting at a table, right, and somebody serves you, let's say main course, right? So you get your beautiful plate, nicely balanced with meat and veggies and whatever it is, and then the hostess says to you, "You must have some more." No, I'm full. You don't understand. Eating meat on Shabbos is like consuming kochim on the Mizbeach. And by kochim on the Mizbeach, it says you're not allowed to leave one morsel over. That's how I motivate myself to exactly finish it all. But you understand what's happening over here? The minute somebody injects into the equation a spiritual variable with parallels avodat Hashem elsewhere, you can see what happens. Now it's not just, I should restrain myself. It's now I need to push myself to have it. It's kochim. Now, the idea is not to convince you. The idea is to show you how if you buy into this, how it motivates you.
There's still the principles of not overindulgence.
Yeah, but if somebody says to you,
so I can see where it becomes
that's what'll happen. But
using your timer to take over, but it's not necessarily like, oh, now
yes, yeah,
that
so
is the
everybody
principle.
will be in that position where even if they're full, they need to make sure that kochim is eaten. You're not allowed to leave kochim over. So if
But
you
it's
were,
not kochim, like
I'm saying, so if you went, but the minute you say it's like kochim, or you even go further, it is a type of kochim, then you will run into this interesting, or you'll run into this.
see how it's a danger.
That's yeah. So that the Gaon would say, the Gaon would not offer you and push you at the table to have more than you need to have. He will. It's not. It's
Not a thing.
not only not a thing. It's asur beyond words. It's not kochim. It's a Shabbos meal. You've done well. You had one piece of meat. Genug. It's enough. Don't. But the opposite approach would say, no. What do you mean? It's like, you understand? The minute you infuse it with a kind of kedusha, then it becomes a mitzvah to have it. So that's the kind of I me personally, I'm kind of guilty of it on the other side of things. Like for whatever reason, I don't even know why, but I find it difficult not to finish what's on my plate. Yeah, I don't know what it was. I don't know what it is. It's like when you were a kid, they hacked you about it, but they hacked me lots of things that didn't bother me. So this thing, I don't know why, it's in my head, it's psychological. It's like I just can't stand wasting. I just have a hard time. I can't find things, anything. I can't handle chucking it out. Maybe there'll be something you can use it
Yeah.
for. It's like people hoard things as a result of
Yeah,
it.
correct.
Like it's
Consciously
yeah,
grasping.
you gotta it's kind of like I think it's in my DNA. That's what it is. It's not
But this
logical
thing, right, it's in your
experience.
DNA, right? It doesn't go off. So it is. That's
Yeah,
right.
so like I think
That's
so for
nice.
me, for example, I'm guilty of this. I will eat. I will eat what I have regardless. It takes a lot for me to leave it. I've got to really dislike it. And then even if I think I'll eat it the next, I'll eat it. Even if I actually don't like the leftovers.
Different.
I'll eat it even I'll eat it rather than chuck it out.
Just tell him something.
And I get a lot of I feel like a martyr, it gives me a lot of self-esteem, But I've thought, like it is, everyone else in the family will reject it on night
What is
three.
it? Tiny's rabbit? Three now.
You know?
See, I have a thing. I will never eat leftovers.
Yeah,
No, but hold
so
on. Leftovers are separate for leftovers.
no, I
For plate.
understand it.
But you
That's a
understand,
different
so when
issue.
I will overeat because I've got this thing that can't go to waste. Someone's got to finish it. I'm going to
It's
finish
not waste. That's probably the thing. It's not
Yeah.
waste. That's why. Yes, A, that's why I got a dog. But B, that's
That's
why
why our dog's
you'd
fat.
rather
I'll
have
feed
like
it. Leave
helpings. So rather dish up small amounts so that it's doable. Because I think also when the plate is too full, you feel overwhelmed. And then it's a chore rather than a joy. So you have a smaller helping, and if you're erring, you go and help yourself three more times. You say, you know, the growing boy.
Yeah. So but you understand the point I'm trying to.
It's the tiniest ride that I think it is that would be out for you. You just leave a little bit on your plate.
Yeah, it's hard. A Rambam. Just to even leave, you always leave a little bit, never ever get full.
No, that's the, he says you should only eat a third full or two thirds.
Yeah,
full.
Just before you.
No, but
yeah.
The rabbit it says you can do a tiny, leave a little bit.
A little bit plate, over, yeah.
And that's like,
well, maybe that's
kind of time.
Yeah.
Just leave a bit on your plate.
Yeah.
You want to eat, but you don't.
Anyway, Bekitzur, it's a very interesting psychological study on how, you know, one looks at this. It's like a really, and I think, as I say, I think that today we're beneficiaries of both traditions. I think 99% of people cannot, not because it's right, but it's very hard to follow a very disciplined life of abstinence. It's really, really challenging. Meaning like tzaddikim, that's why they're tzaddikim, you know? It's like, you know, I'm very jealous of it because it's really hard.
To be even to like have a normal level today, you need to be following a lot of abstinence. Not even like to live a life of abstinence, just moderate. Very
look, you know, just to give you one last example, but you know, in the years that until our last century, but bottom line is that there were Chachmei Kabbalah, right, who used to have certain kavanot, meditative kavanot and intentions, you know, for Yehudim, etc., over cigarettes, smoking, a pipe. Because in those days, they felt that it is kind of like an extension to the Ketoret, if you will, the Havdil. Like they invested smoking with a spiritual property. And so I'm saying. Now, of course, if you argue that point out, it's like killing you, and you turned it into an avodat Hashem.
No, but they didn't know it was killing.
But I'm saying like.
Also, it's like anything physical that's a pleasure should be the same.
Exactly.
Like,
so I remember I can't remember where exactly I saw it. I was reading a Sefer by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. So, you know, he never wrote most of the Sforim, like his children published and grandchildren, sons-in-laws, they published the Sforim posthumously. But anyway, I was reading something because I knew there's a piece of Torah I was looking for. Anyway, I just got sidetracked and I was like looking through the Sefer and I found some interesting anecdotes where Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky offers Moshe Feinstein a cigarette. You know, like wherever they were meeting at, in a good convention it might have been, or even when they were together. And Moshe says no. And then he says to Rabbi Yaakov, he says, Miyom amarti al da'ati, from the day that I became, let's call it a thinker, you know, in other words, somebody who could hold, you know, I never let a piece of anything go past my lips that was not necessary.
That's what Rav Feinstein.
Rav Moshe Feinstein. You know? So all this tanuk, he wasn't even talking health-wise. He also didn't know at the time cigarettes would kill you. You know? And it took a while for people to filter through to him the information that it was deadly, right? But at the time, he was...
It's so nutritional, baby.
But no, in those days, I thought it was. It was like Ozempic, you know? Like and curbed appetite, it like you know what I mean, the weight loss, it relaxed you, you know.
But
you understand, I'm very jealous of that, of that discipline. Very, very, very jealous.
When I was studying psychology, so the late 80s, we were doing alcoholism, and there were all these papers that came out that basically were saying, why is it less likely to be Jewish and alcoholic? Is because alcohol was only used around rituals. And so that's where this was contained. You know, it was a Kiddush time on a Shabbos.
Mm.
And so because of that, you weren't seeing this great extreme alcoholism in Jewish people. Sure. That was, this, I remember the study.
Interesting. Wow.
There's no way that it exists now. That study in the 80s or whatever.
Right. So we lament that it's like spilled over that boundary.
We were actually just dealing with this also, this topic, because in the Piyosetsuna Rebbe, in the name of Shalatova, there's a little thing at the end where he gives practical guidelines how to run the Chevra. And he says, like, you must have a l'chaim every now and then. But he says, and sing the gunim if the moon takes you. He says, but not only that, you also have to learn. He says it very contained, but so that was in the early 20th century. And Rav Moshe Weinberger, you have to hear him on this. It's like, how he talks about, you know, dressing up your tivus with kedusha and calling it kedusha, and how it's like gotten just completely out of hand. But there is a place for it.
Yes.
The Gaon interprets psukim in Mishlei and all over the place. Is exactly this. This was the argument. This was the huge, huge argument. Anyway, as I say, I think there's often the case of whether you can deal with something on a high level consistently all the time. Can the average person do that? And if not, then how do you deal with that? You know, but even if look, two different worldviews, but in principle, I think we're going to bump into it, often as we get to all the minhagim that exist within eating foods.
And also, you can't avoid it because, I think that's like, it's easy, relatively easy when you're fasting, it's easy to go without and to resist the food because it's like all or nothing, and you know it's nothing, so there's nothing tempting. You're not like, but to get involved with a little bit and then, and you can't, you have to eat. So it's like, and we have to be engaged with this.
Yeah,
we have to have suras, we have to laugh. So even without that, it's kind of an issue, no?
But I think also generationally, we've gone away from that, like mindfulness of what you're consuming and the flavor of what you're consuming.
Well, that's what I was thinking when you said before about, like, even when they were smoking, they were like, it's just, that's called mindful.
Correct.
In a way, it's just like everything's with consciousness.
Yeah. But I don't think we do that. It's all gratification.
Mindfully, as long as I know that I'm eating.
Yeah. And that's, they do that with eating disorders where people, overeating, undereating. So how do you eat mindfully and be aware of the flavor of the food and get away from whatever other things that interfere with their food consumption? So you do a lot of these sorts of exercises with people to get them to either slow down or speed up what they're doing.
Yeah.
They consume well and set boundaries. But, if you're eating well and eating slowly, generally you eat less because your brain gets the awareness that it's
food. Yeah.
And so if you were having a proper Shabbos dinner and there was lots of talking and whatever, you are slowing yourself down and therefore you're not necessarily consuming as much as you normally would. But I don't know what people, now we're tired, it's the end of a long week and you just want to get it done and you want people to go home and you, whatever. And so you just like bringing it all to as fast as you can.
Yeah, and as I say, it's an amazing trait to be able to have this level of discipline.
But this drinking is a...
Yeah, it's a question. I think everybody needs to deal with this. Yeah. Okay. I can't have a recording. All right, so stop here. We'll see everybody next week.
You would never say the... it stopped.
One second.